Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge.
I'm Peter Robinson. Born in New York City in 1923, James Lane Buckley received his undergraduate degree at Yale, served from 1942 to 1946 as an officer in the United States Navy, and then returned to Yale for his law degree. James Buckley spent some two decades in private life practicing law and participating in the family energy company. Then he began a public life that continues to this day. From 1971 to 1977, he represented New York in the US Senate. From 1982 to 1983, he served as an Undersecretary of State, and until 1985 as President of Radio Free Europe. And then for more than a decade and a half, he served as a judge on the US Court of Appeals for the DC Circuit, widely considered the most important court in the country after the Supreme Court itself. I say that James Buckley's public life has never ended because he remains a presence as a writer, composing, for example, his 2010 volume, Freedom at Risk, and his 2014 book, Saving Congress from Itself. James Buckley is one of the very few Americans in all of the nation's history to have served in all three branches of the federal government, which makes him Senator Buckley, Secretary Buckley, and Judge Buckley. Please join me in welcoming all three. Jim, we just watched a video tribute to Firing Line in which Rob Long said, quote, "I remember thinking that guy with the clipboard, is he English? Where did he come from?" Let's spend a moment considering that question. Where did the Buckleys come from? Your father was a Texan. Your mother was from New Orleans, if I remember correctly. How is it that the 10 of you were raised in Sharon, Connecticut?
That's a very long story. We don't have time for it. My father grew up in this tiny town in the far south of Texas, grew up speaking Spanish as his second language, went to law school, decided he loved Mexico, wanted to practice law there, got involved in all kinds of things happening. He backed the wrong person in a revolution, got himself expelled, and had to start life all over again. In the meantime, as he became a lawyer for some of the oil companies coming in with, so he, what were his assets? When at age, in the early 40s, he had to start life over again. He knew Spanish law, American law, the language, knew something about what makes an oil exploration concession attractive, but you need money. Where is money? Wall Street. We hear this all the time these days. So that's
it's
how
still
we
there.
Moved to New York. That's why we right.
And Bill's, if this isn't impertinent of me, even if it is impertinent, I'm going to go ahead.
Okay.
Bill's accent, your accent for that matter, there's some mix of Spanish and French. You were all exposed to a number of languages. How did you end up sounding the way you Buckleys do?
It was not my mother's southern accent, I can assure you that. Bill had 1 year in England in his, when he was 14 or 15 at a school in England. And I think that rubbed off on him. I don't know where my, do I have an accent?
You sound like a very genteel Connecticut gentleman.
Okay.
You'll accept that? That's not impertinent. The literacy of the Buckleys. Bill wrote three newspaper columns a week. You wrote countless decisions as a judge.
This you don't want to read those.
This splendid book of essays. Beautiful. Yes. So, your sister Priscilla, editor, managing editor of National Review magazine, a superb writer herself, your brother Reed, your nephew Christopher. Where does this literacy come from?
If you believe in biology, DNA must mean something or other. Apparently my mother, when she was in New Orleans, was writing some articles and short stories and so on.
Oh, really?
So maybe that was a source. My father expressed himself with extraordinary precision, and if we were imprecise at the lunch table, he would say, no, you say it this way. So we were conscious of words growing up.
I see. I hadn't heard that your mother was a writer, mm-hmm. but Bill once mentioned that one of his most treasured, or the family's most treasured possessions, is a copy of Don Quixote, that where your father had marked up words that he wasn't quite sure about. So he mastered two languages. There was literacy just in the house.
Yes.
Right. The conservatism of the Buckleys. Was that your father?
You know, when I came back from the war, I was astonished to find out that my brothers and sisters, you know, that among other things made us kind of politically aware about what was happening here and there, what went wrong here and there. And I was astonished to find out that my brothers and sisters kind of were as enlightened as I was on a whole range of subjects. So I don't recall, we weren't preached at the breakfast table and things of that sort. We weren't indoctrinated. What we did do, and a lot of this attributed to my mother, we grew up knowing American history. We grew up knowing about the revolution, the thinking that went into the forming of our Constitution and so on. My mother used to tell us what she called Nancy stories. She could spin them off the top of her head, you know, bedtime thing and things of that sort. And Martha was a precocious a teenager who was a buddy of George Washington. And as those tales unrolled, we learned an awful lot about where Washington was here, there, and elsewhere, and what problems he had to solve, and of course.
So your mother would tell you bedtime stories that were stories from American history.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That she'd made up.
Yeah. I see, yeah. I did not hear.
Or maybe she'd done research I'd never heard of.
And now, can you confirm for me, mm-hmm. Bill told me this once, but I never was sure if it was a bit tongue-in-cheek, that as children, mm-hmm. you were so thoroughly opposed to the New Deal that there was a horse show over in the direction of Hyde Park one weekend.
Poughkeepsie, New York.
Poughkeepsie, oh, you know this, it is true. Then you tell the story.
Well, I had my sister Patricia was a great at horses, and they had a horse show at the Dutchess County annual fair, and Roosevelt would always be there. And my sister won the blue ribbon, and as she trotted around and got to where Roosevelt was seated,
the President of the United States.
Happened to be President of the United States at the time, yes.
And she looked. She refused to look in his direction.
Exactly right, yeah. She was reprimanded by her father.
Ah, all right.
The President is President.
Yale, mm-hmm. If I have the years worked out correctly, when you returned from the war to go to Yale Law School, or mm-hmm. to finish at Yale Law School, Bill had returned. Bill was an undergraduate. Is that right? You
Correct.
Overlapped
yeah.
in New Haven?
Yes, we did.
All
yes.
right. And he became more or less instantly famous the moment he became the editor of the Yale Daily News.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's correct?
He was chairman of the Yale Daily News, and if you're chairman of the news, you are an autocrat, have total control over the editorial page.
And what was that like to have a little brother ripping up New Haven?
It was fun.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
Yeah. One more. This is lovely because I get a chance to double-check stories with you. Is it true, this is a story from Van Galbraith, that Van and Bill had a bet, and they broke into the Yale Bowl and ran a race around the track. Does that sound right to you?
Never heard of it. Sorry.
All right. Because in Van's telling, Van won. Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling in Bill's telling, it came out the other way.
Okay.
All right. On to Firing Line. Mm-hmm. 1951, William F. Buckley Jr. publishes God and Man at Yale, which makes him famous. In 1955, he founded National Review magazine, which gave him a twice-a-month publication in which he and his friends and your sister were working out their ideas in detail about American policy.
About how to preserve the Republic.
About how to preserve the Republic. In 1965, he ran for mayor of New York, as we heard in the video tribute, when for a moment it looked as though he might win. He was doing well in Staten Island and Queens, and a reporter said, if you do...
Not very well beyond us, but one
Well, two out of five rows. Right. And a reporter asked, what would your first act be if you won? And he replied, to demand a recount. And in 1966, he began Firing Line. We just heard Ramesh Panuru say in the video tribute that it was Firing Line that turned Bill into a full-fledged celebrity. Fair?
I suspect that the mayoralty race did that. He was a fresh voice. John Lindsay was a friend and classmate of mine, and I forget the Democratic candidate.
Abe Beam, I think. Wasn't it Abe Beam?
Yeah,
I think it was Abe Beam.
And they were terribly serious people, you know, this, that, and the other. And Bill threw fun, not only fun into the equation, but total education on critical urban issues. He decided to make that run knowing he couldn't win, not wanting to win, if you will, as a means of immersing himself into a layer of public policy issues that were basically foreign to him. He was talking about, you know, worldwide things, national matters. And he came up again and again and again with an analysis that placed fresh light on the problems people were having in New York. But the important thing is, he was fun. And the reporters were just delighted to focus on what he had to say.
Right. So he becomes famous through the mayoral race, 1965. He's on television then. The New York Times is forced to cover him extensively. And then Neil Freeman and others, clever producers, say, let's turn this into a television program. Right. They try it for 13 weeks. And it lasts 33 years. Rich Lowry said in the video tribute we saw, this was a guy who any producer worth his salt these days would not let on TV. His hair was uncombed, his tie was askew, he was slouching. And yet it worked. Mm-hmm. Why? What did Bill understand to be his success? How did you understand his success on television?
He was a fresh spirit. He was a profoundly interesting and interested person. He wanted to hear the other point of view, and he made a game out of it. All those great qualities. There's just, you know, there are such things as unique human beings, and it's been my joy to be related to one.
Well. You see, I told you you'd understand why Bill always referred to him as his sainted older brother. Mm-hmm. Jim, consider the arc of American history that Firing Line captures, 1966 to 1999. 1960s, one of the guests, William Kunstler, publicly advocates violence. And then we come to the 1980s, and you've got guests, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, who take office, preside over a restoration of morale and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Firing Line captures that arc of history, but isn't it fair to say that in some way or other, and I'm hoping you'll dilate on this, in one way or another, in many ways perhaps, Bill and Firing Line participate in that arc?
Well, I think it's very definitely true. He was there with the people who were making who were making history, who were moving that arc, designing the arc. He was thoroughly knowledgeable about all the implications of what were being said on both sides. He was able to help the audiences understand the meaning of what they were reading in the headlines.
And if I may ask you, I asked Bill, as I said in the video tribute, why he worked so hard. What's your reading on that?
Well, he gave you the answer. We were trained that way.
That is so.
Yeah.
That is so.
Yes.
All right. One reason the Hoover Institution is so fortunate to have the Firing Line archives is that the tapes not only record moments in time, but help to illuminate the present. The year is 1979, and William Buff Buckley Jr.'s guest is James L. Buckley. Would you roll that clip, please?
Bill, I'd like to quote William Buckley to William Buckley. You were asking earlier why Jeff Bell felt that he could communicate an idea to the people of New Jersey and have them understand it, while the editors of a prestigious newspaper could not. Once upon a time, you said that you'd rather be governed by the first 1,000 names of the Boston telephone directory than by the Harvard faculty.
Yeah.
That is, if nothing else survives of your writings, that should go down in the anthology. And what you're saying, really, that there's an awful lot of folk wisdom out there. Mm-hmm. You have people who have run through all the promises of the New Deal, Fair Deal, Great Society, and so on, who have seen all the promises collapse, who have felt the burden of inflation and of taxation, who are feeling crushed. And these are people who live within the economy. And they know something about what induces people to risk money for an investment, and others don't. Now, the problem is that all of the academe, the media, and especially the Congress, incumbents in the Congress, have a vested interest in all the failed programs. They're going to be the last people to understand. And what I find refreshing is the fact that the American people continue to be smart, basically gut smart. And they are beginning to understand where things have gone wrong, and this is where we have hope. But I think that when this crunch comes that you speak of, the American people will be not the well-organized splinterman, special interest recipients of this program or that, but the American people as a whole will be far more willing to tighten belts than, unfortunately, majorities in the Senate and the House. And the question is, can conservatives muster enough pressure from the outside to keep the Congress from going off on tangents as it did 4 or 5 years ago?
Well, I think you raise a very interesting point, but it's one that really comes up against the kind of hedonistic imperative of Jack Kemp. Sometimes I understand conservatives to be saying, look, vote for us because we'll give you back more of the money that we are now taking away from you, that the government is taking away from you. Sometimes you understand that the function of the conservatives is Churchillian. I have nothing to offer you but blood, sweat, and tears. You have got to sacrifice. For instance, the people, the Washington Star asked to make certain sacrifices in order to keep that paper alive. Now, is it clear which of the two courses we are, in fact, recommending to the American people? Are we saying to them, follow Kemp, and follow Jeff Bell and Orrin Hatch, and you will find that there is a dramatic increase in productivity and a decrease in your tax bill? Or are we saying, you've got to work harder, expect less, and agitate in your own behalf with more ingenuity and tenacity?
We have to combine expect less from government with the message, there's no doubt about that, so that you don't have countervailing pressures for precisely a national health insurance that, according to the polls, the public continues to want, even though not understanding what the cost would be.
That's a problem of communication, then.
Yes, yes. Well, what I'm saying, though, that some of the basic thrusts have been won, and I suspect in the case of national health insurance, it is a question that people think that it's a wave of the future, therefore they're for it, whereas most people actually are satisfied with their present health insurance.
That is a remarkable exchange between two of the most important conservatives of the last century. The American people, I'm quoting you now, you quoted your brother to himself, I'm now quoting you to yourself. The American people have run through all the promises of the New Deal, the Fair Deal, the Great Society, and seen all the promises collapse, close quote. You said that in 1979, 1 year later, Ronald Reagan was elected. George Shultz soon after took office as Secretary of State. Policies were put in place that enabled the United States to grow for some 25 years. And now look where we are, roughly back where we were in 1979. What does that say about, does every generation have to screw up on its own and relearn the central lessons? What does this tell us?
It appears that may be true, and if so, there's no future for the Republic, and I mean that quite seriously. If the millennials don't know what socialism means and have to be taught it all over again, there's reason to worry. And I just don't know how we make the kind of progress we need. I still have a fundamental faith in the good sense of the American people, if, but only if, there's somebody around to demonstrate the causes and effects. But I don't see where that voice is right now.
All right. The point of departure for that 1979 discussion mm-hmm. is healthcare. Mm-hmm. We now have Obamacare. Mm-hmm. You spent 6 years in the Senate.
Right.
Is Obamacare permanent, or can that be undone?
It can be undone if you have the right president supporting the initiatives that Paul Ryan has put together. There's no doubt about it, we're not going to go back to where we were, but at least you can have a system that more fairly makes the medical care people require available to them in the kind of competitive environment that enables options to be offered and allow people to make the choice of what will fit their best, their personal needs best, and where there is competition to assure value for services received.
So what you're saying is that the metastasization, I'm influenced by your brother and reaching for a big word, of the administrative state, we needn't resign ourselves to that. Even at this stage, it's a question of political will.
It's a question of political will. It's a question of getting Congress back on, focusing on national levels, not dissipating its energies on trivia happening at the local and state levels. There's no simple answer to the
right
thing you've just put out. But it is the thing that really worries me is we have now created an administrative apparatus that has almost beyond Congress's control. It's going to be awfully difficult to bring it back under control. Mm.
Once upon a time, Bill, I'm quoting you again. This is you talking to your brother in the clip we just saw. Once upon a time, Bill, you said you would rather be governed by the first 1,000 names in the Boston telephone directory than by the Harvard faculty.
I think Sewell was right there, 2,000.
2,000. All right, we'll make that adjustment. Yeah. Would he say that today?
Absolutely.
He would.
He would. And I think people with common sense would, or people who look at what's happening in our colleges these days would.
So you would maintain, pessimistic though you may be about this or that aspect mm-hmm. of the American experiment, mm-hmm. virtue still resides in the people.
Yes.
A couple of final questions before we ask if there are questions here. You have 8 grandchildren, mm-hmm. and goodness knows how many grandnieces and grandnephews, since you were one of 10 yourself.
I have, my parents had 50 grandchildren, so you can take it from there.
50 grandchildren.
Right, yes.
If I get into heaven, it's going to be because I say, I knew the son of a woman who had 50 grandchildren. Last question before we turn to the audience. How do you sum up Bill? What do your grandchildren need to know about your brother?
How can you describe him? I don't think it's possible. At least I don't have his vocabulary. How's that?
Fair enough. Nobody does. Yeah. Fair enough. Final question. I see Secretary Schultz here, and if I'm correct, the two of you met in 1970, not long after you had been elected to the Senate, mm-hmm. when you were invited to the White House to meet Richard Nixon for the first time. Would you tell what happened when the door to the Oval Office opened and you walked in?
Opened, and there was the president back behind his desk. And I heard President Nixon say, but Milton Friedman doesn't realize there is an election coming up, which said to me that the three of you agreed that Milton Friedman was right, but politically it wasn't, in judgment of Richard Nixon, it wasn't convenient to follow that advice, and it was at that instant that I came to the conclusion that term limits are required. 6-year term for the president, and limit members of Congress and the House to 12 years each. Make service a privilege, not a job.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've been celebrating, by and large, William F. Buckley, Jr., but I think you can agree with me that his sainted older brother is A, indeed sainted, and B, a very remarkable American in his own right. On this, the 50th anniversary of Firing Line, James Lane Buckley, thank you. For Uncommon Knowledge and the Hoover Institution, I'm Peter Robinson.